Fraternal greetings and a warm welcome to India's first and only Freemasonic podcast, The Ashlers. A unique podcast that is hosted by Masons aiming to share information and the timeless wisdom around Freemasonry with the rest of the world, thus sharing the light of Masonry far and wide. As a disclaimer, the thoughts and opinions shared by the hosts and participants on The Ashlers is solely their own and thus do not represent any official positions or proclamations of any Grand Lodge thereof. Be assured that best efforts have been made to keep the conversations and presentations on the level for brethren and non-Masons alike. Hello and welcome, folks, to another episode of The Ashlers. This is Season 2, Episode 8. Now, before I reveal, or rather before Rinesh reveals further details about this episode, let me just give a little segue into what is special about this episode. This episode is going to be a wonderful paper, but it's a long paper. Not every good thing comes in small packages. Sometimes they come in big packages. With that, I'll just say this. This is an amazing paper, but it will be recorded in three different parts. So this episode is dedicated to the part one of the entire paper. We will be covering some really important points, but before I reveal what those are, let me hand it over to Rinesh to introduce the paper, the author, and the overview of this episode. Rinesh, over to you.
Hey, thanks you, Shishir. I remember when we were discussing what we should do with this paper because it was really long. And it was still interesting. Right from the first word till the last word, we felt that there is something which we shouldn't miss. So the first idea was obviously trying to condense it. And then I realized that we will not be giving due credit to the paper and we will actually devoid our listeners in understanding what this paper is all about. So with that, that's the idea where we thought, let's just divide this paper into three parts. It obviously helps us also in spending time into this. So the paper is all about the rise of Freemasonry, written by Right Worshipful Brother Dr. P.K. Muthukumaraswamy from Lodge Rajasabhai number 212 in Madurai, part of the Grand Lodge of India. Now, this paper has actually divided, or rather we divided it into three parts. Obviously, Muthukumaraswamy sir just wrote it as one, but we thought we'll divide it into three parts. So the first part, which we are going to cover today, is going to talk about where did Freemasonry come from? What is all about this operative masonry? And then we will move into some of the written proofs about these Freemasons, or rather the Scottish element to it. And finally, we will end into how this operative Freemasonry transitioned itself into speculative Freemasonry. And that is the overall gist of this paper. Many of us would have thought that, yes, I have already heard about this. It's very interesting and all. But you might miss out one of certain key elements which we are going to cover in the paper, which has been written so beautifully by Dr. P.K. Muthukumaraswamy. And that is exactly why, please stay put, listen to the entire episode, and you will thoroughly enjoy this.
Completely agree. And let me just give one little tidbit about what I learned from this, you know, from the part one that we divide the paper into. I always thought about lodge as a place where you can stay for a long time, have food and whatnot. Apparently, the very early origins of not even the word, but the concept is slightly different. I will come to that in due course. But just as a preview, into those special little nuggets of wisdom and information that this paper contains. All right.
Exactly. So let's start with the first question which the paper actually asks. Where did Freemasonry come from? So, and I'm quoting it from the paper itself. The consensus opinion is that it originated among the operative Masons of Britain. How and why did these working class men evolve into a body of moral instruction communicated in meetings, which is what we see today? The answers probably lie in what Shishir is going to add right now.
Great. Now, with anything, you know, that establishes itself, over a period of time, there is a lot of aspect of evolution that happens, and that evolution gets influenced by many different factors. In this case, in case of masonry, some of the things that the paper points out is centuries of development and evolution, diverse influences like the decline in building trade, the changing social scenarios, Scottish operative practices, religious persecution, religious upheavals, changing political climate and whatnot. So there are many things that come together. Now, like in business, we talk about the external environment and the internal environment, right? So these are so many different factors that come together and coalesce into a single point that leads to that tipping point where things change and evolve and re-change and re-evolve.
And the next few sections which we are going to cover in this talk today will explore the craft of operative masonry and the influences that probably resulted into the Freemasonry that we know today. And Shishir, over to you to talk a little bit about operative masonry.
Yes. Now, operative masonry. If you think about the word operative masonry, obviously it means that you are doing some sort of an operation. If you do some sort of an operation, not like surgery kind of operation, but it's like you're doing something on some material with some tools, with some skill set, you know. So operative masonry is something that came into being, like, you know, if you go by the paper, it says, take a trip down memory lane back to the 11th century, where the Duke of Normandy, who was a vassal for the King of France, he defeated King Harold II in the Battle of Hastings in the year 1066, and basically established the Norman rule in England, which continued for many years. Now, this particular event in history, this victory that happened, it gave rise eventually to something called the Freestone Masons. Now, why is that important? Because the Norman conquest, they gave heavy importance towards building. Now, the English lands, England, was basically in the hands of kings, nobles, and church. They were all very eager to build. They had the land. They wanted to establish their presence. The church was on their side. And they were all like, let's build churches, cathedrals, abbeys, palaces, and castles, and whatnot. Now, when you want to build something, what do you need? You need materials. You need people. You need tools. You need knowledge. You need skills. And that's all that came together. And it is quite likely that they built around 5,000 churches just in England during the 20 years following the Norman conquest. In 20 years, 5,000 churches. These guys were on an assembly line, it seems. Now, the question is, who carried out these constructions? Now, I earlier mentioned that you need people, you need tools and materials and whatnot. Right? Now, the paper does a very good job of actually breaking down the kind of skill set, the kind of people who were involved in this building operation. So they were the quarry masons or hewers who would work in the stone quarries. They got the stone. They would, you know, shape it in a rough manner. They would sometimes carry it, through all its stages of, you know, fixing that stone, because obviously the stone is imperfect when you get it right. So you have to shape it, you have to tool it. Now, they would then take it to the site, and they would then give, you would have a bunch of people called the layers or the setters. These are the people who worked on the building site itself. So you have a bunch of people working in the stone quarries, getting the stones. Then you have these setters who are at the building site. Now, among this entire group of people, there were the most important group were the Freestone Masons or Freemasons. Now, here is a very interesting thing that I learned from this paper. Freestone, it seems, was a kind of stone that was quite versatile. You could, shape it, you could mold it, you could carve it, and it would still be firm, it would not break, it would not develop any faults. It was a very versatile stone, kind of like your vanilla ice cream of sorts. You know, it would go with mostly any flavor. So these freestone masons, that stone was called a freestone, and people working on the stone were called freestone masons or freemasons. These people were skilled sculptors of this particular kind of stone. And these guys would eventually be like the forefathers of what Freemasonry is known as today. Now, I'm talking about a very early stage. Obviously, a lot of changes happened. But if there are, you know, some group of people that you can call as the originators, there's a good chance you can put these guys up there. Now, and another interesting thing about the lodge, but I think Rinesh has a point to give there. So, Rinesh, over to you.
So just to add to that word freestone, right? Initially, when I heard the word freestone, I actually thought that maybe this is a stone which is easily available or something. But then I came to know that it was a different type of a stone. It used to be said that it does not develop faults and flaws, irrespective whether it is carved with the grain or against the grain. And that, for a person who would have worked on a stone, would understand that when you are trying to carve stones, right, you need to actually go with the proper flow, because the moment you try moving it, or rather going against the flow, the stone might chip in a very different style and you might not get the smooth structure, which is, sorry, the smooth shape which it actually has, or the smooth outer layer which it actually has. I visited a temple in Karnataka, which is near Belur, and another place called Hallebidu. Now, these places, right, if you look at the stone structure over there, right, when you look at that, you realize that, my goodness, these guys would have had so much an amazing knowledge that you actually spent years and years into these things. And trying to chip a stone is one work. Trying to mold it into a shape is another work. But trying to work with such a kind of a stone, which, if you are not very careful, will just destroy that entire stone. I know stone is easily available, maybe, but whatever work you have done till now suddenly goes into drain and you again have to try all over again. It's not easy. And these masons were not masons who would have just joined. Like, for example, I would say like an engineer who just studied 4 years of engineering and thought, yes, he knows everything. He needs years and years and years of practice. And these masons actually did that. And these masons, that's why, continued that learning experience, continued understanding these things to come to that stage. And we are going to cover this after the lodge aspect, which Shishir is going to talk about. But that is the complexity of that stone. And people who try to master it are amazing folks. And that is why there is so much of importance on that freestone. Maybe that is where these two words came together. A mason who used to work on freestone. Freestone plus masons, Freemasons. One of the possible explanations of the origin of this word, Freemason. And with that, I'll move on to the lodge aspect, which Shishir was talking about.
Something interesting came to my mind. So let me ask you this question. And I'm curious to know what you might say. And listeners, this is not at all rehearsed, okay? So Ritesh has no idea what I'm about to ask him.
Okay.
Okay, Ritesh, so tell me, what is the freestone of our time? Any guesses?
Suddenly I'm trying to figure out a lot of stuff. Are you talking digital aspect? Are you talking material aspect? I'm not very sure. I'm drawing a blank. What is it?
So let me go back to the freestone. What was freestone? It was something which was basically a material that you could mold, you could carve it, and it would still give you an output that you need. So you could modify it as per your requirement and get an output, correct? Now, the way the parallel I'm drawing is, in today's time, today's freestone is nothing but software. What is software, right? Software is just a bunch of instructions. You give it to the computer and the computer does whatever you want, whether it's adding two numbers or, you know, giving instructions to drive a car without a driver in it, like Tesla kind of does, right? It's all instructions. And that is a freestone of today.
That's a good analogy. I was, as I said, I didn't know whether you were going digital or material. But yeah, that's actually a good one.
So listeners, those of you who were also trying to guess along with Renesh, if you got it right, please do let us know. Our email is theashlerspodcast@gmail.com. We would love to know how many of you got this right. Or if you think there's something else which could possibly be the free stone of the modern age, then we would love to hear from you on that too. All right. On the lodge. So Renesh, you were about to throw some light on that. So go for it, man.
Yeah, I wanted to bring out to the notice of people who are not Freemasons here and who are listening to us. Whenever I used to tell them that I'm actually going to the lodge, and we used to use this word so casually, right? We never realized who the other person was. As in, normally, if I have to tell my family member, right? I normally used to tell them, oh yeah, tomorrow, by the way, I have a lodge meeting. So they will understand because they know who I am and what I'm doing. But imagine if I have to tell this to a friend of mine who might not know much about Freemasonry, or even though they know what Freemasons are, they do not know the exact meaning of every word. So when I used to say that, oh yeah, I'm going to so-and-so place. Like for example, next week, there is a meeting of the Regional Grand Lodge of Southern India. So when I was actually telling it to certain folks, I said, oh yeah, I have a lodge meeting. And I'm going to Madurai for the same. So they suddenly will think, oh, lodge, that means you will be staying in the same place. I'm like, what? No, I will book a room for myself in some other place. Why did you think that? And they were like, you just said you are going to the lodge. And that's when it suddenly struck me that the word lodge, right, has an amazing meaning to it. But in today's term, everybody tries to correlate that with boarding and lodging, which is very common. And what exactly is boarding and lodging? It's something. And by the way, if you just Google it and try to figure out, it's a place where for a shorter duration, you accommodate yourself. And that is super interesting because Shishir is going to bring that element as well as what else the word lodge actually defines. Shishir, over to you.
Thanks, Renesh. And that's an important point you raised, because until now, even I felt boarding and lodging is kind of like the same thing. And, you know, even today you have a lot of so-called lodges, but not in a Masonic sense. Is actual places where you can kind of stay, but that's in today's time. But in case you're thinking, what was considered a lodge back during the Norman conquest and during their reign? Well, the paper gives a very simple explanation actually, and that itself suffices and summarizes everything. So let me read it verbatim. When a building of any importance was started, the first thing to do was to erect a shed in which the workmen could dress stone, meaning work on the stone, keep their tools in order, train their apprentices, take their meals, or spend some part of their rest time. This was the lodge. In most cases, the lodge was a rough and ready affair with possibly a boarded or thatched roof, but where the work was expected to last a man's lifetime, then a substantial lodge was built. Now, what I gather from this is basically as follows. If you're engaged in building anything, you need some place for yourself as a builder or as a workman working over there. You need some place to rest. You need some place to keep your tools, some place where you can sort of do some pre-work, maybe mix the cement and, you know, before you go and start laying the bricks and whatever. You need one temporary little area. So that was considered a lodge. Now, going by what's in the paper, typically that would be a very temporary kind of a structure, easily broken down, easily set up. But if you had a much longer duration project, where let's say you're building you're building a church which has an abbey. Abbey is basically a place where the religious congregation would have their places for them to stay and eat and whatnot. So if that's kind of like, you know, an entire operation that you're engaged in, so obviously you're going to be spending a few years over there at least, because again, remember, we did not have cranes back then. We did not have cement disposing trucks coming in. So everything took time, right? So this would not happen in 6 months time or whatever. So if it went for a pretty long period of time, they would make a more permanent structure, which would be a designated area where, you know, the workers can come and do that stuff. So that in those times was a lodge. Whereas in today's time, that meaning has carried forward in many different ways, and again it has evolved, and as we know it today, a lodge in today's time for the common man is a place where you can sort of stay. So that's why you have a lot of lodges near railway stations and bus stations and whatnot, right, where you can sort of come and stay, spend some time and move forward. However, in the Masonic sense, the lodge is different. It's again a place where you don't come to stay, so to speak. You come there, you have your meetings, you do your rituals, you know, in some lodges people even have food. So, you know, you would have those socializing activities and then you go away within a day's time. Again, it's a temporary place to do Masonic specific things and you move away. Rinesh, you want to add anything more before you move on to the next part?
No, I think you covered everything in that respect, that you're just coming there, making sure. And most important point is, it is not where you're going to stay forever. And why I'm going to add, I'm emphasizing on that point is because the next portion which we are going to cover is going to explain that bit. So let me first come to the next portion and I'll come back to this point. So operative Freemasonry, when it started, right, it was a very lucrative affair. You were highly prized individual because you were not just person who can bring two things together and say, yeah, voila, this is a building which we have made. But you are supposed to have a lot of knowledge with respect to the geometry of the place, with respect to the geometry of the stone, with respect to the understanding the stone, with respect to understanding the land where this is going to be built, because the foundation has to be done. And you and me both know that the buildings which we construct today, and the buildings which were constructed back in the medieval European era, are way different. Today, yes, we have cement. Today, we have these iron rods and bars, which actually bring all these things together. We didn't have that at that time. So there was a certain way of preparing it. As a matter of fact, if you ever notice the Machu Picchu area, right, in South America, the way those stones have been fused together without a gap, without cement being attached to it, imagine the precision which it actually needs. And that is exactly why the degree system which Freemasonry has, and I'm talking again on the operative aspect, I'm not even coming to the current method which we have, is what will explain you this. So, as I said, joining the group of Freemasons was always considered very interesting because you get to learn these things. But it is not something which can be learned overnight or in 15 days or maybe in 15 months or maybe in a year. It takes years and years to go through that. So when a person who would like to join this group, he approaches maybe a learned person over there who knows about all these things. He comes to them and says that I would like to learn from you and everything. And they take him into this. By the way, all that thing apparently used to happen inside that room, which is called the lodge, where a young fellow who will come and say that I would like to become part of you guys and understand the trade and understand how it works out. And that's where this guy is actually attached to a person who's already well-versed, like a master. So that person used to be an apprentice, or in our modern sense, now that Shishir brought this whole modern concept of Freestone as well, in the modern sense, it's like an intern. What does an intern do? Apart from the fact that he literally has to slog with a whole lot of stuff, but otherwise that intern actually stacked to a master or tacked to a person who does the work better. And he learns from them. And from that, he or she actually develops their own work. And that is exactly what used to be. Coming to the paper, what it says, apprenticeship among Masons must have existed in early medieval times, but there is no record of it earlier than 1356, in the year 1356, in the London Masons Regulation. It is in 1430, in the reign of Henry VI, it was passed, who passed an ordinance confirming the ancient form and custom of putting and taking of apprentices in the city of London. In about 1530, a 7-year apprenticeship was fixed for the whole kingdom. And this 7 year is going to be very interesting when I bring the next portion. So as a young lad, you will get attached to a person who knows the trade very well. You are an apprentice for that person. You will learn, literally be with him. And that 7 year of apprenticeship is what is going to make sure that you understand. Sometimes obviously it's going to be more, but at least minimum used to be 7 year. By the way, it is said that he was then allowed to do a certain amount of work on his own account, But till then, he was not free to undertake a building enterprise involving the employment of subordinate labor. So as an apprentice, you used to do that. Then you move from that stage to being fellow craft. And entered apprentice's full freedom came up some 7 years later, or sometimes more, when he becomes a fellow of the craft. The craft in this sense is the work which they are doing. He was then fully qualified as regards to the membership of the lodge which he's connected to, and could also undertake other contracts as an employer. Incidentally, as early as 1598, the admission to the grades of both entered apprentice and fellow craft was actually of an esoteric nature. In spite of the fact that it being an operative, it is there. Now, the 7 year is a very interesting concept. Those of who would know a little bit about ancient India, the Gurukul system, which used to be followed, also used to have this 7 year option. So in certain places, the son or the daughter, or like the kids, basically, they will always be attached to an ashram or a hermitage, where a guru who knows the, these religious books, the way of living this life, the way of handling the society, all these small things, he used to know about it. So these kids used to actually get attached to that ashram, hermitage, or to the guru. And for at least minimum 7 years, they will learn under him. And after that, and by the way, not only just learn, they also learn about how to take care of a house, how to cook food, how to clean the dishes, how to do all those things. So that hermitage used to have a guru and his wife, and they too, being the father figure and the mother figure in their life, will teach everything on how to take care of yourself and the society. And that is what they used to learn in that 7 years. So that is why that whole 7 years was very interesting, because somewhere in the ancient India, the same concept was being used. And in the 1300s, the medieval Europe also used the same concept. We have a lot of theory why these things came together. But just to keep it simple, information flows through merchants, through people, through trade. And that may be how something which used to happen so long back in India was also followed in medieval Europe. It might have also been followed in China. It might have also been followed in the remote part of Africa. You never know. 7 years is something which was very interesting. Now, post this, coming to the last stage. Once you become fellow of the craft, you have become really well-versed in that craft, well-versed in that art, in the trade. You then become to be the master mason. Master mason, as in, on an operative style, used to be the person who will take care of that lodge. And coming back to the paper, it says, the master mason was always the most important person amongst the English medieval free stone mason. In early days, it was he who was the employer's agent, who designed the building, arranged for the supply of every scrap of material, and personally directed the whole of work. He was known at different times by a variety of names, sometimes like overseer, keeper of the works, director, clerk of the works, surveyor, supervisor, magister, etc. He was literally the most important man in the building for 2 or 3 centuries. That is what the importance was. So coming back to that, entered apprentice as a young fellow craft, when you know everything, and master mason to oversee everything. And that is what the operative masons was part of. Shishir, would you like to add anything in this?
I think, Dinesh, you put it in a very, very simple form. I think the only parallel I could possibly draw, which you have already done using an intern as an example, right? The only addition from my side would be this, that as you start any work, whether it's software, whether it is into hardware, anything, you need to give that due time to learn and master whatever it is that you're being taught. At the same time, it's a double-edged sword. The person who is an expert needs to give that dedicated time to teach that new person what this whole craft is all about. As that back and forth happens, you are essentially, what you have in your hands is a free stone in the form of that intern. You have to mold, you have to craft, you have to shape, so that the output is a human capital, a bunch of knowledge, a person with a lot of potential. If that due effort is not given, it's wasted effort, wasted time on the master's part as well as the learner's part. Rinesh, you're about to say something?
No, I was just going to use the word superb. Superb.
Thank you. I think that would be the only thing I would say, because the reason I bring that up is because if we think about the future of masonry today, the future lies in the hands of the experienced brethren out there today who have got a wealth of wisdom. After all, our masonry today is not operative. It is speculative for the most part, meaning we delve on the teachings, the lectures, the ceremonies, the tools, the symbols, and all of that. And it also lies in the hands of the entered apprentices, the people who are getting initiated. They most of the time do not have much idea into about what Freemasonry is. They have vague idea from the internet. Most of it is usually negative. Going by the research I had done, you know, even today there's a lot of negative, misleading and false information out there. But still some people do come forward. But these are the people who need to be handled with care, because the future is being passed on by the people who have lived masonry, who have understood masonry, and pass the torch on to the new blood, the new generation, so that they can take those teachings and evolve that even further, refine it even further, mature it even further. So all brethren out there, new or old, give masonry the due time and you will never regret it. That's something that comes out of my own experience.
Cool. Oh, so let's move on to the next segment, which is called the Mason Word. Now, again, bringing that whole lodge aspect, which I was talking about, it's a temporary place. Now, you will definitely be tagged to a building and you will be working on the building. But chances are that maybe there are so many folks and you are employed to do a certain portion, and maybe that portion got over. Now, in that sense, either you will actually work on something else, or you will say that, okay, maybe I need to obviously enhance more of enhance my skills into something else. I might have to move to another town. Now, that is where the Mason word is very interesting concept. Now, we are talking about a medieval Europe where people were actually not well versed in writing or reading. They were master of their trades. So if a cobbler is there or a potter is there, he knows the trade in and out. He knows it very well than you and me could have been, even after reading or learning everything, will know, because he has dedicated his time, effort, life into that thing. But when it comes to writing or reading, he might not. Now, let's say if that person, now in most honesty, a cobbler or a potter or a tiller of the land might not actually move away from the land. It's the masons, the stone masons, who used to go from one town to the other. Now, these guys, when they move from one place to the other and they go to a new place, what is the proof that he is actually good in it, or rather he's a fellow of the craft, or he has been a master mason? What is the proof? In today's date, what would be the proof? Again, thanks to Shishir, I'm bringing a lot of modern analogy in this one. Today, what is the proof that you have actually been, you have actually done some job in the previous company, and what exactly you've done? It's your resume or your curriculum vitae, or rather a reference from your previous employer. Now, how would you take that into the medieval Europe? Yes, reference would definitely be the case. But imagine this, the master mason over there, who know what this fellow of the craft is actually doing, is also uneducated. He doesn't know what to write. He doesn't know what to read. So how exactly that information will go? And that information at one point of time used to go in the form of a mason word. There were certain words given, or rather followed, among stonemasons, which used to be used, or rather which was used to identify a mason or identify a free stonemason from another mason. Also to identify a mason from a person who is saying that he is a mason but is not, who wants to like fool people by coming up and trying to work into this place and take the wages and not do a proper job. So that is where the stonemason comes into focus. Reading from the paper, the medieval mason's occupation required him to accept a degree of mobility. On completion of one job, he had to travel, possibly far distances. Thus, a mason necessarily had to join parties of complete strangers. In order that such traveling masons were accepted by their new companions and employer, they apparently had developed some signs and words. So those were the signs and words which may have been called the mason sign or the mason word. it is definitely known that the Scottish Mason trade bodies had introduced a mode of recognition lacking which any operative, whatever his skill and training was, regarded merely as semi-skilled or even as a mere laborer. This, according to the paper, is called the Mason word. The Mason word probably came into existence to protect the Scottish Mason trade of the towns from the competition of country Masons coming to town to seek their fortune, as also to limit the number of apprentices at one time. The Mason word was apparently accompanied by some secret sign delivered from hand to hand. Early documents suggest that the Mason word was circulated amongst the brethren at the conclusion of the ceremony of admission. I am not bringing the speculative aspect, and we might delve into that in future, but just concentrate on this from the operative aspect followed in the English Mason. In the medieval European time. That is how the information was given to the new fellow, and that new fellow of the craft, will take that when he goes to another place. Shishir, do you have anything to add into this?
Just one thing that, you know, it's fascinating to see how concepts have evolved, and yet in its very essence still remain the same, right? Back then, although they couldn't read or write, and yet they have built structures that are standing even today. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, and, it is.
Yeah. And a person who's traveling from one building project to the other, how does this person justify or give proof of his work? I mean, it's not like he just walks to another town where something else is being built. He meets the manager, so to speak, and says, hey, give me a stone and I'll just carve it and show you. It's not like a 1 minute thing, right? Or even if you take an interview, you could always still sort of fake it. But what is that sure proof that you really know what you're saying? At least to get your foot in the door. And that's how people would go with this, this Mason word. In today's time, of course, we have our CVs, we have LinkedIn, we have certifications, we have recommendations on LinkedIn and whatnot, right? There are job sites where you can find new job, and it's all doing nothing but the exact same thing. Talking about you in a credible manner. That's the basic essence of it. So I think that would be the only parallel that I can draw to this, Ritesh. Over to you.
Perfect. You just added that cream which I wanted on top of this cake which we have. So
thank you.
Now, when you think about all these Masons coming together, right, you still need an organization. And that is where a guild, G-U-I-L-D, or also spelled as G-I-L-D, was formed. It's an association of craftsmen or merchants formed for mutual aid and protection and for the furtherance of their professional interest. Now, this guild used to have a list of all the Freemasons who were part of a certain area or a certain group, mostly for that town, I would rather say. So that guild used to take care of it. And what did this guild do? The guild used to take care of their Masons. The guild used to ensure that tomorrow there is a problem with that person, maybe because of some accident or maybe because of some personal issues or something, they will take care of that. Now, that guild used to obviously collect certain amount of money from each of the Masons as part of like a fund, which that fund will be utilized for the benefit of each and everybody. All that things used to be done by that guild. And you used to be part of a lodge, and the lodge might be part of a guild. So that used to be the kind of a structure which was followed. Now, based on their economic function, guilds also serve many other purposes. Like, for example, it said that the guild was associated with the patron saint, and a local guild would maintain a chapel in the parish to be used by its members. Several guilds in the town often took over the annual public conduct of the miracle plays based on part of the Old and New Testament in the Bible. This is all in the medieval European time when they used to understand what needs to be done, and they used to do all these things. The guilds also perform charitable work, not only for their own members, but also for the members of the community. Guilds also apparently build and maintain residences in which the membership would hold banquets and conducts businesses. The craft guild system has gained a foothold as early as 1100 back in England, and flourished for some few centuries. Records of actual mason guilds are hard to come by, but it is said that during the Tudor and Stuart times, which was between 1485 to 1600 and 1600 to 1700, the paper says that they have found that masons formed into actual guild in conjunction with their building trades. Now, this medieval organization was probably of a regional level, like or a small local level kind of. But think about it from today's perspective. Let's talk about a certification which you do, as Shishir was mentioning, like a Scrum certification which is done. As there is a community which takes care of all those members who are part of the Scrum community to ensure that they learn more, they understand things. Same goes for PMP, same goes for Lean Six Sigma, same goes for anything which you can think about. All these things has a very humble origin back in medieval masons in the form of guild. Which, by the way, listeners, it's still being followed. And there are some companies which are mason companies are there. There are some guilds which are still in place. Shishir, do you want to add anything to this?
I think you've already done that when you brought in PMP and everything. You know, again, goes back to the same thing where obviously when you're working on any body of work, you know, there'll be nuances to it. And then people develop skills which would be addressing the overall aspects of that body of work, or it could be a niche skill, something very particular but extremely important, right? And then when you are part of that fold, obviously you want to have more people that are in the same line of work, and then you sort of form your groups. So it's nothing but just that, the feeling of togetherness, you know, coming together. Not just to fulfill Maslow's theory of, you know, that hierarchy pyramid, but more on the lines of sharing best practices, or maybe learning about some breakthrough that someone's doing. So I think it kind of just goes back to all of those parts. So with that, folks, our part one of this wonderful paper is coming to a conclusion. But I won't leave you hanging there. I would like to also give you a preview into what's coming up next. For that, I will hand it back to Dinesh.
Hey, thank you, Shishir, for this. So next episode, we are going to talk about the operative lodges and guilds in Scotland. And there is a little bit of emphasis on Scotland being the part of this paper is, well, stay tuned for that. But apart from that, we are also going to talk about the Shaw statuettes, the Regis manuscripts, the charges of a Freemason, the old charges. There are a really interesting bit which is pending. So please stay tuned. Wait for our next episode wherein you will understand. And Shishir, I know you are very excited about this whole Scottish element. Would you like to add that? Why?
Yeah, sure. So for those of the listeners who may not be aware of this, the lodge that I'm part of, it used to be a Scottish lodge back in the day before they came under Grand Lodge of India. So I would really like to know a little more about the Scottish aspect of what Ramesh is talking about in this paper. Now, listeners, thank you so much for your time, taking the time to listen to us. We get appreciation emails, people reaching out to us and telling, you know, that they enjoyed a certain episode. And those, you know, few words here and there really lights up our day, because it gives us that feeling that, okay, what we are doing, the time and effort going into sitting and recording this, you know, reaching out to Brethren to get the papers from them, reading the papers, you know, preparing our script, editing it, preparing all the graphics, and then, you know, submitting or rather disseminating it across all the different WhatsApp groups, and then uploading on, you know, the platform, podcast platform. All of that effort is being well received, and that really helps encourage us and makes us a little more motivated to continue doing this. So I would say, brethren and all listeners, our email is there in the show notes, theashlerspodcast@gmail.com. Please do feel free to write a note if you really like what we are doing. But if there are things where you feel we can improve, definitely we are all ears, all eyes are open, and you definitely want to know how we can make it better. Finally, if there are brethren out there who would love to have us feature their paper like how we have been doing for a few other brethren till now, definitely write us a mail, attach your paper to that, and you know, we would put it in our pipeline and we'll plan for it. So feel free to do that as well. Do keep in mind that this is a public, it's an open forum, so it's open to Masons and non-Masons as well. So any information that you are submitting to us will be subject to such an open forum. So please do make sure that whatever you're submitting, please be clear as to what aspects you would like us to talk about, which is open for discussion in an open forum. So with that, thank you. Thank you again so much, Brother P.K. Muthukumar Swami, for sharing this wonderful paper with us. We are really enjoying it. And, you know, like I said, amazing things should be given the due course of time and dedicated effort. So we would really look forward to discussing the other two parts of your paper. So stay tuned. And those listening to this and those who know Brother P.K. Muthukumar Swami, please do let him know that you enjoyed his discussion on our podcast. So with that, thank you. This is Shishir signing off.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap. We thank you for your time and hope that we have been able to present to you the true light of Masonry in yet another way. Please continue to watch out for more episodes from the Ashlers by subscribing to our channel on most of the popular podcasting platforms. Links are in the show notes, and also feel free to email us at theashlerspodcast@gmail.com. Your encouragement is what keeps us motivated above all. As proud hosts of India's first and only free Masonic podcast, we wish you all the very best. And until next time, the Ashlers signing off.